On this January 14th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your Thursday headlines. Security continues to escalate across Washington in advance of next week's inauguration. In news today that the entire National Mall will be closed for Inauguration Day, only accessible by media and security personnel. City and federal officials say the closure is the latest in a series of security measures to essentially harden the nation's capital against the type of violence that stunned Washington, D.C. last Wednesday. In the final days of his presidency, the Washington Times is reporting that President Trump is growing more isolated and angry. We'll talk to Dave Boyer later in the program. In what is expected to be his final trip, says Vice President, Mike Pence will travel to the Naval Air Base in Lemoore, California this Saturday and the Army's Fort Drum in New York on Sunday to thank the Navy pilots and the Army soldiers for their service. As the number of COVID-19 cases continues to rise, the incoming Biden administration outlining new details on plans to stimulate the economy, provide direct relief to Americans, and increase the production of those life-saving vaccines. The price tag in the trillions. And the Federal Reserve indicating that interest rates will stay near zero for the foreseeable future. Jerome Powell making his comments in a Washington Post live event earlier today. The story shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin with some sobering numbers from the CDC. In the first 2 weeks of the new year, more than 38,000 Americans have died from coronavirus. And this projection for the next 3 weeks, an estimated 92,000 Americans are likely to succumb. Right now, 130,000 people in this country are hospitalized with COVID-19, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention advising that while the end is in sight with the vaccine rollout, the nation's still facing challenging times in the months ahead. Among the states hardest hit, Georgia, which now has the fourth worst rate of hospital admissions in the country. As governors deliver their State of the State addresses this month, Republican Brian Kemp on what the state of Georgia is now facing.
The state prioritized the fight against COVID-19 in two other specific areas: PPE procurement and additional health care personnel staffing. Activating the Georgia Emergency Management and Homeland Security Agency statewide network, the state secured entire warehouses of PPE from hundreds of vendors, which was immediately sent to hospitals, nursing homes, doctor's offices, and other health care providers on the front lines. Because of their around-the-clock efforts, under the leadership of former Director Homer Bryson and Director Chris Stallings, the state now has at least an 80-day supply of all critical PPE categories. As our hospitals and nursing homes confront the fiercest part of the pandemic, the frontline health care workers in these facilities have literally faced hell on earth. They've worked under brutal conditions for multiple shifts over months now. There's no doubt that Georgia's healthcare heroes have done their job with a grit and determination that has inspired 11 million Georgians. Never has it been clearer how important your job is and how vital all of you are to keeping our state healthy and prosperous. I want to thank you for sacrificing your time with loved ones, for going above and beyond the duty each and every day. God bless you all.
And of course, C-SPAN continues to track the speeches by governors in their State of the State. That was Georgia Governor Brian Kemp earlier today. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporting that statewide, 9 out of 10 ICU beds are full, and nearly half of those patients in intensive care, they're suffering from COVID-19. And out west in Utah, Governor Spencer Cox outlining his plans to prioritize Utah's vaccination program.
Last week, I stood here and told you that we were going to significantly change the way we were administering vaccines and increasing the speed at which we were doing that. I want to thank all of our partners who stepped up and took the call to heart last week. Today, we have administered 133,202 doses. Now, that is really significant because if you compare it to where we were 1 week ago, we were at 68,030. So in the course of 1 week, we basically doubled the amount of vaccines that we have administered, over 60,000 vaccines administered in 1 week. So, as you know, we started letting teachers get the vaccine this week. Tens of thousands of teachers have already received the vaccine. We're so grateful for them and what they're doing to help us keep our schools open. We recognize that there were some changes or potential changes, some advice given by the federal government yesterday, potentially recommending starting to vaccinate those who are 65 and up. We announced last week that on Monday, those 70 years of age and up would be eligible for the vaccination. We're going to continue with those 70 years of age and older for a couple reasons that I will explain shortly, and not open that up to 65 and over yet. And the main reason for that is that we have so many people 70 and over who want the vaccine that adding 65 to the mix would not change that. There will be no availability because we don't have enough vaccine assigned to the state of Utah right now to even cover those who are 70 years of age and over the next several weeks.
That update from Utah's Governor Spencer Cox earlier today in Salt Lake City. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is planning to release nearly every available dose of Pfizer's and Moderna's coronavirus vaccine to the states. The advisory team has had a number of conversations with vaccine makers about the supply issue. Dr. Celine Gounder is on the Biden coronavirus panel. She's also an infectious disease specialist at NYU's School of Medicine. And during a conversation sponsored by Johns Hopkins University, she outlined what to expect once the new administration is sworn in next week.
I think it's important to understand that the Biden brand, so to speak, is to follow the science. And so I think from vaccines to therapeutics to diagnostics to other public health recommendations, everything is going to be informed by the science. Now, we've had a bit of a preview, you could say, of the Biden plan in the last week or so. The president-elect has announced that the plan is to release nearly all doses, and it's important to say nearly because what we're saying is we're not going to be holding back second doses of vaccine. We're going to be releasing nearly all with a small buffer left over because we want to accelerate the pace at which vaccination is going. This is really a decision about how to manage the supply. It's not a recommendation about the dose of vaccination or the schedule of vaccination. So that is to say that the Pfizer dose should still be full dose, the second dose at 21 days, the Moderna vaccine should be given full dose with the second dose given at 28 days. So that's part of what you're going to see. The team has also realized that some of the guidance, the CDC and ACIP, while very well-intentioned in terms of trying to prevent disease, death, and do so equitably, the vaccine recommendations have just been very hard to operationalize on the ground, very complicated. And so we essentially need to make things simpler, whether that is simplifying the supply chain, as I noted, or simplifying the tiers of who is eligible for vaccination. And so that's really what we're getting at with opening it up to persons over the age of 65. But as we've seen in Florida, that's easier said than done. And so that does require some real planning and some work with the states to figure out how to operationalize that on the ground. So with respect to vaccination, those are some of the things that you're going to be seeing under the Biden administration.
That assessment from Dr. Gounder, she was part of a public health conversation sponsored by Johns Hopkins University and serves on the Biden coronavirus panel. Dr. Lena Wen is the former health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. She contributes to the Washington Post, an expert on COVID-19 and public health. And earlier today, I asked her for her reaction on why we're seeing a surge in the number of deaths as a result of coronavirus.
Well, my reaction is that so many of us have become numb to these numbers. This is a shocking number that would be completely unimaginable if we rewind a few months back to say that we will have more than 4,000 people dying every single day from coronavirus. But that is our reality. As to why this is the case, it's a combination of things. It's a combination of what happened over the holidays. It's a combination of people letting down their guard because of pandemic fatigue setting in. I think also there is this unrealistic expectation that people have about vaccines. Many people think that, well, vaccines, great news, they're here, they're going to save us from this. But actually, vaccines are not what's going to get us through this surge. What's going to get us through the surge right now are all of us following those basic public health guidelines we've been talking about all along that people have gotten sick of, but still are so critical. And that's mask wearing, physical distancing, washing our hands, and very importantly, avoiding indoor gatherings, including with extended family and friends.
You're often asked this question, how long do you think these lockdowns will continue in this country where so many Americans are essentially forced to stay home and limit what they do outside the home?
Well, if I may, I think it's important for us to not use the language of lockdowns. I'm against lockdowns and the idea of these strict stay-at-home orders because our science actually has evolved. We know, for example, that being outdoors is much better than being indoors. And so I would encourage people to socialize outdoors, to get outside and exercise and see one another in backyards and in parks, because we're in it for the long haul. It's going to take time. And we cannot think of ourselves as having to hunker down in a basement without seeing people and being in isolation. We're not going to be able to get through this pandemic that way. We need to be doing activities that are as low risk as possible, reducing risk wherever we can, but also keeping the things that are really important to us. I see your point, though, that there are a lot of measures that we're going to have to keep on doing, including the masking, the physical distancing, and so forth. And unfortunately, because of the glacial speed thus far of our vaccine rollout, we do have to keep up these measures for quite a bit longer. It's difficult for me to see how in 2021 we're going to stop masking and physical distancing. I do think that as we get more people vaccinated, we will be able to do a lot more things, including seeing our loved ones. But I would still warn people that vaccines are one more layer of protection. And until we can get to herd immunity as a population through vaccination, we're going to have to keep on all these other measures as well.
Let me remind our listeners, we're talking to Dr. Lena Wen. She is the former Baltimore Health Commissioner. Her work available in The Washington Post. And I want to get your reaction to the plan being rolled out by the incoming Biden administration to essentially release every available dose of the coronavirus vaccine. You wrote about this recently in The Washington Post. Your reaction?
Look, I very much appreciate President-elect Biden's attention to the urgency, because this has to be a wartime mobilization. There should be no expenses spared. We should be devoting all of our attention to expediting vaccine rollout. I agree that we shouldn't have vaccines sit on shelves and freezers when they could be saving lives. Here's my concern, though. I want there to be an absolute guarantee that for every first dose of the vaccines that are given, that for these vaccines, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine, that we're also giving the second dose in time to these same individuals. This is how these vaccines were studied. If not, if we don't follow this protocol, it's actually going against the science. And I know that President-elect Biden has said that he wants to abide by the science, but if we don't have an absolute certainty about an intact production chain, if we also are not absolutely certain that we'll get the speed of vaccinations figured out, because already we're having trouble distributing the vaccines that we have. If we release double the number, are we now going to have trouble vaccinating the first dose for people and keeping on top of the second dose? If we're not able to do this, it could add to vaccine hesitancy. And actually, I don't know what I would do with my patients, because right now so many of my patients have the concern, are they going to be able to get the second dose? They want to get that 95% protective effect, which is the reason why they're taking this vaccine. If I cannot guarantee them of that second dose, I'm not sure that I can even recommend this vaccine to my patients. And so that guarantee of a second dose is going to be so critical. And I hope that in the President-elect's speech tonight, that he will guarantee this timely second dose.
And of course, all of this coming as the CDC is reporting that states are expanding those groups eligible for vaccinations, which means you need more doses.
Right. I do think that the expanded eligibility criterion is needed, because there have been reports from so many different places that are so tragic of doses literally being discarded, of vaccines being wasted, because the criteria for who can get the vaccine have just been too strict. That should not happen. There is a serious misalignment between supply and demand, and increasing the eligibility and opening up the flexibility will help with that. Now, of course, the demand is going to initially far outstrip supply, and that could lead to a lot of frustration when people don't know if they're eligible. Our public health systems are going to be overwhelmed because local public health has been underfunded and understaffed for years. So we need to get more funding and resources to these local health departments. That's going to take some time to sort out. But still, that's a better problem to have than to throw away this extremely precious commodity that, if it were actually injected into people, could immediately start saving lives.
Dr. Lena Wen, we thank you for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
On Wall Street today, stocks closing lower, the Dow losing 69 points, the NASDAQ off by 16, and the S&P down 14. Meanwhile, tonight, the Biden administration, led by the President-elect Joe Biden, proposing a $1.9 trillion rescue package in a speech in Wilmington, the plan to combat the economic downturn and the COVID-19 crisis. The President-elect will also propose more than $400 billion to combat the pandemic directly, including accelerating the vaccine deployment plans, another $350 billion to help state and local governments bridge their budget shortfalls, and for families, a $1,400 direct payment for those who qualify. We'll be talking with Richard Rubin of the Wall Street Journal just ahead. Meanwhile, during a webcast sponsored by Princeton University, the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell indicating that the U.S. is a long way from a strong job market. It's another indication that interest rates will remain low for the foreseeable future. Last Friday's jobs report by the Labor Department showing that the U.S. losing 140,000 payroll positions in December. During what was a wide-ranging discussion available at C-SPAN.org, the Fed chair spoke about how the central bank is handling the challenges brought on by this pandemic, as well as his expectations for what's ahead.
So you're right that the COVID shock just strictly as a matter of the arithmetic of the decline in the first and second quarters, the COVID shock was significantly larger. But really, the two episodes are just fundamentally different, and the most important differences are not really about size. So if you go back to the global financial crisis and the Great Recession, they resulted from the buildup of unsustainable imbalances in the economy in the form of a housing bubble that popped. And then an undercapitalized banking system amplified that shock rather than absorbing it. And that system ultimately needed to be bailed out by the taxpayers. There were also lots of points of failure in the non-bank part of the financial system as well. And going into the crisis, household indebtedness was quite high, a lot of it in the form of completely unsupportable mortgages. So when the housing bubble popped, the housing sector was buried in debt and foreclosures came in. And you were in right away in a very, very slow and painful and long recovery. Very different situation here. The pandemic was effectively a natural disaster, right? And it struck an economy that was performing well. Now, every economy, and certainly our economy, faces plenty of longer run challenges. But I would say there were no obvious imbalances that threatened the long ongoing expansion. You really can't identify something that looked like, yeah, this, if this blows up, it could blow up the expansion. The banking sector, as I mentioned, was much better capitalized, had much more liquidity, a far greater appreciation of its risks through thanks to stress testing and such. We did see some problems this time in the non-bank sector of the financial sector, but less so than in the GFC. Households were in relatively good shape going into after many years of deleveraging. Corporate leverage was high, as I mentioned, but we haven't seen really the payoff there in a negative way. So there's another, as you pointed to this, another critical difference is this time, both fiscal and monetary authorities responded very quickly and very powerfully and in a sustained way. Critically, it was sustained.
Those comments earlier today from the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. And joining us on the phone is Richard Rubin. He is a U.S. tax policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. A major speech tonight by the president-elect on COVID-19, stimulus, and the economy. What can we expect?
I think we can expect the president-elect to really lay out how he sees this as an emergency and what he wants the American people, and more particularly Congress, to do in the weeks ahead. He takes office next Wednesday with the virus deaths thousands a day. The economy still struggling and jobless claims up, as we've seen. And so it's this sort of crisis atmosphere, and I think you can expect to see him try and detail that and then talk about what he wants from a policy sense to happen to help resolve some of those issues.
And we know from last Friday the president-elect saying that it will be in the trillions of dollars. What kind of support will he have in Congress, and what are some of the biggest pitfalls that he may potentially face as he tries to move this through?
There's generally some support in Congress for another round of stimulus checks, for essentially taking the $600 per person checks that we saw in December, approved in December, and bumping that up to $2,000 a person. And so to the extent that he's going there, there'll be some support for that. When you start getting into things that are Democratic priorities or can be labeled as Democratic priorities, then it gets harder, and it gets harder to do any sort of bipartisan package. And so state and local government aid is one that's been a flashpoint between the two parties. There are other programs, I'm sure, that, you know, that Democrats favor that Republicans are less willing to do, sort of significant bump ups in unemployment insurance and extensions of those programs. So I think you may hear some of those things from the president-elect, and then the thing to watch for is sort of the pushback from Republicans in the hours and days afterward.
And, of course, this comes with a record debt and deficit. As somebody who covers U.S. tax policy, will we see changes to the tax code to bring in more revenue to the federal government in the year ahead?
In the year ahead, maybe. In the months ahead, probably not. And I think that's an important distinction. The Biden team has been pretty clear about their views on deficits, that, you know, not that deficits don't matter, but that in the sort of economic emergency we're in, that, and with interest rates so low, that it's not a priority to pay for things now. And I wouldn't expect to see that pivot to starting to pay for things until sometime later this year. I think the thing to watch for is, as you're watching Congress in the weeks ahead, is to really see what can be bipartisan. And then if not, because Democrats will have majorities in the House and Senate, very, very slim ones, where they seek to go through the budget reconciliation process that lets them pass tax and fiscal measures without needing to get any Republicans at all. And so that balance of the sort of message of unity that you may hear from the president-elect and the sort of reality of what it might take from a partisan perspective to get policy through is one thing that we'll be keeping an eye on in the first 6 to 8 weeks of this administration.
More details on this Biden plan available at WSJ.com. Richard Rubin here in Washington, thank you for being with us.
Great. Thank you.
And welcome back. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio, also available as a podcast. In politics, President-elect Biden planning to select former South Carolina Senate candidate Jamie Harrison to chair the Democratic National Committee. He had run the South Carolina State Party before challenging Senator Lindsey Graham last year. Axios.com reporting that Harrison will replace outgoing DNC chair Tom Perez. And the national debt continues to surge. 4 years ago, it was at $20 trillion. Newsweek.com reporting that since President Trump has been in office in the last 4 years, the overall debt has risen by $7.8 trillion to nearly $28 trillion. That's with a T, the number approaching levels that we hadn't seen since World War II in terms of percentages. Well, speaking about Senator Graham of South Carolina, he is warning that impeaching the president over his comments before last week's attack on the Capitol is what he views a rushed process. Senator Graham say it will become a threat to future presidents. And what appeared to be a warning to what is a growing number of congressional Republicans backing the idea of officially convicting the president, including that from Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell, the South Carolina Republican, in a statement yesterday saying that his colleagues are, quote, doing great damage to the party. And then last night, he made these comments on Fox News.
We'll play this out. We impeached the president today without any evidence. It's just sheer hatred. If this becomes the norm, be careful what you wish for today. Under this theory, the radical left, if you can impeach a president after they're out of office, why don't we impeach George Washington? He owned slaves. Where does this stop? So to my Republican colleagues, let's stand firm for the idea, whether you like Donald Trump or not, he's not above the law. If he did something wrong, you know, he can face the consequences of the law. Impeachment is political. What we're doing here is we're impeaching the president without any evidence, without any witnesses, and we're going to have a trial after they're out of office. How do you survive as a president in the future? This will be an attack on the presidency in perpetuity. Should we impeach Barack Obama because for 24 hours he never lifted a finger to help those people under siege in Benghazi?
Based on their standards,
Senator Graham last night on Sean Hannity's Fox News program. His remarks come as freshman Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene announcing her plans to impeach President Biden. On Twitter, the Georgia Republican saying, quote, on January 21st, I would be filing articles of impeachment on President Joe Biden. 75 million Americans are fed up with inaction. It is time to take a stand. I'm proud to be the voice of Republican voters who have been ignored. Congresswoman Greene has not announced her exact plans or if other government representatives will be following her lead. At rollcall.com, there is this story on what happens during an impeachment trial after the president has left office. Quote, there's no clear answer to whether Chief Justice John Roberts or a Democrat would preside over a second impeachment trial. The Constitution states, quote, when the president of the United States is tried by the Chief Justice shall preside. Roberts did preside over the first impeachment trial a year ago, just the third such trial in our country's history. But what happens when the president leaves office next Wednesday, January 20th? Must the Chief Justice still preside over the trial, or could he choose to do so? Or does the role fall to the presiding officer of the Senate? That, of course, would be the new vice president, Kamala Harris. Or can the Senate have its president pro tem? At that time, Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy, would he preside? Or can the Senate pick an alternative? Constitutional and congressional experts have no clear answer. The situation has never come up before, writes rollcall.com, like so many other legal issues in the Trump era, and the nation's founding document is silent about it. The full essay is available online. Former FBI Director James Comey suggesting that President-elect Biden should consider pardoning President Trump if he faces criminal prosecution after leaving office. The president, by the way, firing Director Comey in May of 2017. In a BBC interview last night, James Comey saying that a potential pardon from Biden would help as part of the healing of the country in getting us to a place where we can focus on things that are going to matter over the next 4 years. And today, during a Washington Post live event, James Comey was asked about the current state of affairs in our country and the level of responsibility by the president.
Well, I think Donald Trump both reflects and furthers a trend in this country. He didn't start it, but he's become the prime mover in the last 4 years, 5 years, to destroying norms and institutions that he sees as threats and to trying to destroy the idea that the truth can be found at all. But he is to blame for the flamethrower that's been taken to the institutions of justice over the last 4 years. Now, he has lots of acolytes around him who've echoed the lies, so they've been heard thousands of times by American citizens. But Donald Trump is the one who has tried to burn down the Justice Department. Again, with help from people like Bill Barr, but to do that because he saw it as a threat. For the same reason he's tried to burn down the media and portray it as an enemy of the people.
I think about some of the things you write about in both of these books, moments when the president did not face consequences, moments when leaders who could have made a difference didn't step into the fray. What is our hope for returning to a normalcy in the next presidency or the presidency after that, if justice is so easily undermined, if the independent objectivity has so many forces working against it, if Donald Trump, who wasn't exactly the most organized tactician, could accomplish this, what hope do we have going forward?
Well, we have hope because we've done it in the past, never more clearly than after Watergate, which I write about in the book, when the Department of Justice had become a tool of Nixon's partisan attack on many parts of our democracy. And so we're reliving that history in a way against a different, very demagogic leader who has poisoned the minds of millions of Americans with his lies. But the path back is similar. Internally, we just need the right leadership in the Department of Justice. And I think the president has selected as his attorney general nominee the perfect sort of person for that role. That's actually going to be easier to restore the department internally. The harder part's going to be winning back the trust of those who've been surrounded in a fog of lies over the last few years about the FBI and the Department of Justice. And that's hard to change because you can't get people out of a fog of fraud by yelling at them and telling them that they're morons or their facts are wrong. You have to do it slowly by showing them what competent, honest leadership looks like. And I'm optimistic that the president, new president, will do that, and his attorney general and the other leaders that he's selecting. But that takes time. That's a much longer term struggle, even than locking up the miscreants who are trying to tear down our United States Capitol.
Those comments from former FBI Director James Comey to the Washington Post earlier today, out with a new book titled Saving Justice, Truth, Transparency, and Trust. And in the Washington Post, we woke up to this headline this morning. President Trump is isolated and angry at aides for failing to defend him as he faced impeachment again. Josh Dossie and a team of reporters writing that, quote, when Donald Trump on Wednesday became the first president ever impeached twice, he did so as a leader increasingly isolated, sullen, and vengeful. With less than 7 days remaining in his presidency, Trump's inner circle is shrinking, offices in his White House are emptying, and the president is lashing out at some of those who remain. The president also instructing aides not to pay Rudy Giuliani's legal fees and has demanded that he personally approve any reimbursements for expenses, some which could be as much as $20,000 a day. More details at WashingtonPost.com. And the Washington Times is reporting that the president is, in fact, in seclusion, has been blacklisted by social media companies, and growing more frustrated in these final days. Dave Boyer is covering that story. He is a White House reporter for the Washington Times. We spoke with him late this afternoon.
Well, Steve, in the last week of his presidency, President Trump is increasingly isolated. He's talking to fewer and fewer advisors. More and more people have left the West Wing to, you know, pursue other jobs, and they're not coming back, obviously. And it's a quieter, more depressing place to a lot of people. And there's some great frustration among the staff also at the way things are ending with the, obviously the riot at the Capitol by Trump supporters and the second impeachment yesterday.
And according to your reporting, some of the president's staffers calling it, quote, heartbreaking and depressing.
Well, sure. I mean, they've been working as hard as the president has for the last 4 years, and, you know, to make sure that his agenda was enacted. And for the first 3 years of his term, they were having quite a bit of success, you know, particularly on the economy and judicial appointments and, you know, other areas. And, then came the COVID pandemic and, huge amount of job layoffs and the loss in the election and all the drama since the election about whether, you know, there were allegations of fraud and whether they could prove that and culminating in this, second impeachment. And they feel, a lot of people feel like the last events of the last week are really all that the president is going to be remembered for. And it's there's a feeling among some that it's kind of wiping out right now, at least all the work that they've done.
Also, as you point out, his inability to communicate with the country on Twitter or other social platforms, he's basically been banned from those media platforms. What can we expect in the remaining days of this presidency?
We just saw an example of it today. The White House press office released a press release statement by the president just calling attention to his efforts to reduce troop deployments around the world, Afghanistan and Iraq. Normally, it's the kind of thing that Trump would have done in a tweet and have been done with it in, 30 seconds. But instead, they issued a press release today about that. And you're going to see a lot more executive orders in the next few days on remaining issues that Trump wants to address. And also, I think we're going to see another wave of pardons very shortly.
Isolated and impeached, Trump ending his presidency on a sour note, the reporting of Dave Boyer, available at WashingtonTimes.com. We thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Steve.
And now to next week's inauguration. National Guard forces from a growing number of states moving into positions around our nation's capital. It comes as authorities continue to examine the extent of those threats surrounding the president-elect's inauguration, all while making sure they prevent a repeat of last week's deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. By next week, more than 20,000 National Guard officers will be in place. In addition, federal officials leading tabletop exercises, rehearsing inauguration security, and strengthening coordination among a massive patchwork of police and federal personnel expected to fan out through the weekend in advance of next Wednesday's transfer of power. And to that end, Vice President Mike Pence traveling to the FEMA headquarters here in Washington for a briefing on security. Here's part of what he told reporters.
Well, we all lived through that day of January the 6th. And as the president made clear yesterday, we are committed to an orderly transition and to a safe inauguration. And the American people deserve nothing less. And I'm looking forward today to hear about the efforts. We're deploying the full resources of the federal government to ensure that both of those occur. I look forward to the details of those efforts. Let me just say to each and every one of you, it's been my great honor to serve as your vice president. And should this be the last time that we're together, let me extend my gratitude to each one of you for your service as well. Our aim here, the American people can be confident, is that we're going to ensure that we have a safe inauguration, that President-elect Joe Biden, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, are sworn in as the new president and vice president of the United States in a manner consistent with our history, with our traditions, in a way that gives honor to the American people and to the United States.
That from Vice President Pence at the FEMA headquarters here in Washington. He will be traveling to the Naval Air Base in Lemoore, California on Saturday and Fort Drum in upstate New York on Sunday. The president is, of course, skipping next week's inauguration. However, Vice President Pence will be in attendance on the west front of the U.S. Capitol. Authorities are warning governors in all 50 states to also be prepared for possible demonstrations and potentially some violence. In Ohio, for example, Governor Mike DeWine saying that the State House and other state buildings in downtown Columbus will be closed through Inauguration Day. This as police prepare for the possibility of protesters by those supporters of President Trump. Governor DeWine speaking to reporters earlier today in Columbus.
Further, I have, at the request of our federal government, I've authorized the deployment of 500 more members of the Ohio National Guard, making a total of approximately 700 members of the National Guard that will be, and some are already, in the National Capitol area in Washington, D.C., or close by. We are, of course, part of a national effort. And our Guard always is part of that national force. We have unique capabilities. We have special personnel and special equipment that has been specifically requested by the federal government for us to deploy to Washington, and we have responded and done so. Along with Speaker Kupp and Senate President Huffman, we are announcing today that the State House will be closed this coming Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Further, I'm also ordering all state office buildings in downtown Columbus to be closed on these 4 days as well. State personnel will work from home or work from other assigned places. Finally, it is time, I believe, for us to come together as a country, as we always do after elections. It's time for us to observe the peaceful transfer of power and to remind ourselves of what brings us together, binds us together, holds us together as Americans. Our love for freedom, our love for liberty, our love for our Constitution. And that is what we'll celebrate in the days ahead.
And a situation likely to be seen in other states around the country, that from Ohio Governor Mike DeWine in Columbus earlier today. On our podcast, The Weekly, we talked to presidential historian Jim Bendat. He's the author of Democracy's Big Day, The Inauguration of Our President, A Pandemic and Security Concerns Here in Washington, D.C., making next Wednesday's inauguration unlike any other in our nation's history.
Well, the tradition is that we have a peaceful, orderly transition of power. That's the tradition. So it's pretty historically stunning that Trump has made the decision to become the first president in 152 years to not attend the inauguration of his successor. We just don't see that. This is just the fourth time in history.
And of course, we know the politics behind that decision by the president, but what's the symbolism?
Well, the symbolism is one that really demonstrates to our country, as well as to people around the world, exactly how our country works, that we have this democratic system where there is that peaceful transition, as I mentioned, and that's symbolic because it's not that way in so many other countries. So other countries look at us oftentimes with amazement that we do things in such an orderly fashion.
Jim Bendad joining us on our podcast, The Weekly. It's available wherever you get your favorite podcast. And this program, Washington Today, also available as a podcast. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully in Washington, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Every day, we're taking your calls live on the air, on the news of the day, and discussing policy issues that impact you. Coming up Friday morning, a conversation on COVID vaccine distribution efforts with Business Insider healthcare reporter Andrew Dunn. Then we'll talk about the House Republican agenda after President Trump leaves office with Brendan Buck, who served under House Speakers Paul Ryan and John Boehner. Watch C-SPAN's Washington Journal live at 7 Eastern Friday morning. And be sure to join the discussion with your phone calls, Facebook comments, text messages, and tweets.